I would say that there isn't a better time to be involved in education and technology. And the reason I say that is that we have probably more greater challenges in education than we've ever had before, but we also have a much vaster array of tools and resources to help us be effective as teachers and educators. And it's just an incredibly exciting time to be a teacher. And when I think back to my teaching days almost 20 years ago, and I think about what I wanted to be able to do then that I could do now, I can only tell you that I am very, very excited and very enthusiastic for the next generation of teachers.
Educator Linda Roberts. She's here to talk about information technology and American education. Welcome to Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Major funding for this edition of Soundings comes from the Computer World Smithsonian Awards Program, established in 1989 to honor innovative uses of information technology that benefit society. It's a paradox of our modern world that although computers are so pervasive, they still play a relatively small role in our classrooms. But thanks to the innovative efforts of a growing number of educators, scientists, scholars, and business professionals, the common ground between information technology and American education is expanding dramatically. One of these innovators is David K. Allison of the Smithsonian Institution and the National Museum of American History in Washington, D.C., where he supervises the Information Age exhibit. David K. Allison is the Chief Smithsonian Officer of the Computer World Smithsonian Awards Program. These awards recognize achievements in leadership and innovation in the workplace, the arts and sciences, and in the community, especially in American education. Before we turn to that topic, I asked David K. Allison to comment about the growth of information technology and the development of the World Wide Web.
Wayne, the interesting thing about the Internet from a historical standpoint is how, in fact, uncontrolled it is. Much of the original funding that made the Internet and the World Wide Web possible in the United States came from the federal government. But in fact, there's no federal regulatory commission that oversees it. There's no federal communications commission that runs the Internet. If you compare it to the establishment of the telephone network, it's less controlled than that. Many of the computers that were originally on the Internet were government computers at national laboratories, but quickly other computers in private industry and other organizations became connected to the Internet. Uh-huh. The information on those is not under the control of the government, but under the control of the individual people who put the information up.
Is this a good thing or a bad thing? I mean, not to turn our conversation to partisan politics, but we hear a lot of criticism coming from both the left and the right. Who's in charge of the Internet and who can have access to what kinds of information? Are we speaking here, in your view, as a historian of science, are we talking about freedom of speech or are we talking about technical things?
I think in general it's a good thing that things are so free and open. There are certainly issues related to that. Mm-hmm. But the good news is that in a democratic society and in an age when we don't have polarization between East and West, there's a lot of openness to let people experiment, to let people put up the kind of information that they want. The issues related to pornography or scurrilous information or negative information that really hurts people are mm-hmm. serious issues, and sooner or later we're going to have to deal with them. There are technical issues about whether it's easy to send viruses across the Internet or break down computers or destroy the whole network through different things. Those kinds of safeguards are going to have to be developed. But most of the people that I talk to are very interested in keeping the free flow of information as open and as experimental as possible so that the mm-hmm. creativity of humans can be fully expressed in this new form.
Well, now, you may be too close to it, David, because you do what you do at the Smithsonian and as a historian of science, but are you fundamentally optimistic that we are not going through something that is qualitatively different compared to historical models? We're just going to have to adjust to a new form of technology as we learn to use the Internet and the World Wide Web.
I am optimistic about it. I'm optimistic about the new relations between educational information and commercial information being mixed together. One of the disasters, I think, of what happened with television and even radio in the early days is that commercial interests became too much involved and controlled the networks too much in the early days. Mm. Later, there were additions of other kinds of information as the cost of the technology came down. With the internet, there's a mixture from a very early stage of educational information. Even individuals can mount their own home pages as publishing their own personal information on the internet because mm-hmm. the cost's so low at the outset.
Does the word anarchy come to mind? As a professional, again, historian and somebody who knows a lot about computers, how do you surf the net, so to speak?
Well, it is somewhat anarchical in how it's organized. The hope for saving grace is the power of information technology to do searching as well as providing information. Uh-huh. So what I do is go into the services like Yahoo, which is out in the West Coast, to provide access to different organizations and categories of information, let the computers find the information by searching across the whole web.
David Allison, we're talking about the Computer World Smithsonian Awards Program and what you do at the Smithsonian Institution as a curator of information technology. Give me a sense of what is going on that large, amorphous landscape out there that we call education and computers.
The fundamental thing that's happening, Wayne, is that the focus is increasingly less on computers as tools where you have to learn a lot of skills. That is, computer education being learning how to program a certain language, learning how to use a keyboard, learning how to do just skill-based things, and increasingly more on using computers as tools to access information.
Mm-hmm. In other words, the gizmos, the flash, the razzle, and all of that is receding, and we're really addressing the educational, intellectual issues involved.
Yes, there are certain technical things that have made this possible. The cost of computers has gone down, the increase in processing power, the increase of memory in computers. This has allowed the coming of what's called the graphic user interface. Mm. That is a mixture of images and layout of screen, so you don't have to know command lines. You can just move a mouse around the screen and point and click.
In your view, David, are we raising a generation of kids that somehow or other more literate, less literate, differently literate compared to the old days, for lack of a better term?
Well, you may remember back in the 50s when you and I were growing up, if you had an automobile, you probably were a mechanic. And you had to learn how to fix it.
And
you
had
to
know
how to deal with the valves and things like that.
Right.
And that was the early days of computers. You almost had to be a hobbyist. Uh-huh. Now the reliability is going up and the ease of use is increasing, so you don't have to focus as much on how to do it and just plug it in and do it.
Fair enough. Well, again, come back to education and computers. What, in your view, is the most exciting kind of thing that's happening as these two things come together?
Wayne, the most exciting thing that's happening is the use of computers to access information across networks that stretch around the world. I can remember very well the day that I could sit in my living room on a Sunday morning, dial up the Library of Congress, and do bibliographic research that used to take me hours in a matter of a few minutes. I've sat in my same living room and accessed museums in France, libraries in Europe, sites all over the world to pull information right to my home computer.
Uh-huh. Should I argue with you along the following lines, David? I used to hear the same thing about the cable industry, that we would have all these wonderful channels available to us, that it would revolutionize education, that our students would become more adept at what they're supposed to be doing in the classroom. And yet, 20, 25 years after the debut, so to speak, of the cable industry, we've got 500 channels with 500 reruns of Gilligan's Island. Are we headed in that direction when we speak about information technology and our students?
I hope not. I think that the difference is that the university community and the educational community was plugged into this development of computer networks from the outset.
Uh-huh.
The only fear that I have is that as the growth of the commercial interests comes along, that those educational interests will get pushed out. I hope that doesn't happen. I don't see any chance of it happening at the moment,
mm-hmm.
but it's the one thing that I do fear.
David Allison, you're from the Smithsonian Institution. We're talking about computers and education. One of the folks who was nominated, one of the finalists for the Computer World Smithsonian Awards program this year, is a gentleman by the name of John Zebarth from the University of Illinois. Tell me very quickly about John, and then we'll listen to some of his comments.
John works at the National Center for Supercomputer Applications in Illinois, and one of the things that National Supercomputer Center has done is broadened out its work so that it looks not only now at the use of supercomputers for advanced scientific research, but also use of supercomputers to provide information across the educational spectrum to users not only in universities, but also in schools from kindergarten up through 12th grade.
So we developed a program in Alabama, which is a statewide program where teachers come and learn how to do computational science. Again, the motivation was to put the concept of computation into the science curriculum, because it's not there today in most textbooks. It's not there today in the training of a teacher in a science area. So we did the program, and we had phenomenal success in areas that we had not anticipated. We had success with minority students in what would not be considered your science and math excelling classroom, because the students suddenly were learning a programming language, but at the same time they were learning how to do a project in science. And so the teacher had, they had to learn a programming language. The teacher gave them access to a machine, a supercomputer. They had access through the internet, and they had to do a project. They had to display the project at the end of the year. And for many of these students, it was the first time in their life they had ever done and completed a science and math project. And this program was adopted by the Department of Energy for four other states in a program called Adventures in Supercomputing. And then it was adopted by NASA for three other states in a program called Explorations in Supercomputing. And so we have now hundreds of schools where they have courses in computational science. This is how I got started, very much in the science end of it. This was pre-Mosaic. This was them using the internet to access supercomputers. Mosaic, though, and the information that is now out there affects not just science and mathematics. It affects all of the curriculum. And it has been amazing to me in the past 2 years, 1 to 2 years, to see so many school systems across the country understand the importance of this and begin to get involved. It's been exciting to see state departments of education, for example, in Illinois, make a real and a determined commitment to connect the schools in the state, both the haves and the have-nots, a real determination to get the teachers prepared to understand how to integrate technology into the curriculum. And so now, wherever I go, I have people who literally want the information, will travel to get the information, and will integrate it at the best that their budgets will allow. I visited a school system last week where they passed a bond referendum, and they have $15 million, and they're putting fiber into every classroom. They're purchasing new computers for every school in the district. And they're out there trying to find out the right way to do this. And that's really what we at NCSA are trying to do, is provide tools and help them do it the right way. And there are other groups around the country doing the same thing. So I see really a renaissance taking place here in how technology, computing and information technology, is being integrated into schools from kindergarten through high school. And our universities, I think, will catch up here pretty soon.
David, we just heard there from John Zebarth of the University of Illinois. We're talking about computers and education. One of the tools that John and his colleagues use is Mosaic. These are all capital letters, some sort of a, what is this, an acronym? Explain that term to me.
Mosaic isn't an acronym. It's just the word of providing access to information, little bits of information all over. Mm-hmm. What Mosaic is, it's something called a browser. It's a piece of software that you put on a personal computer, and it allows you to access information through something called hypertext on the World Wide Web.
Well, again, we're back to the sort of library analogy. You walk in the door, and what kinds of choices do you make?
Yes, that's right. It's the tool that allows you to click from one place to another throughout the world. It puts together images and text together so somebody on their computer can format information mm-hmm. with an image, with text, and with reference points that go to other places. Provide that, and then through Mosaic on your computer, you can have that information put back together the way it should be and provide ways of jumping to other bits of information that the person who created the document intended you to go to.
Well, who pays for all of this? Just as a quick sidebar, when we talk about surfing the net and using Mosaic, for example, as an educational tool?
The costs of the internet and its use are spread out in many different ways. Some of the costs of maintaining the network are paid for by the federal government. Many are paid for by the universities and the commercial establishments that put their own information on the internet. Individual costs for your own use of your personal computer you bear. So you may, if you have access to the internet, have to pay a service charge to somebody like America Online or CompuServe to get access.
Mm-hmm. Is it worth it? Now, I realize that I'm putting you on the spot because what you do by virtue of your connection to the Smithsonian as a curator of information technology, is it the sort of thing that parents should simply wait, like buying a digital watch or buying the next generation of computers to get involved in?
I think it all depends on what you want to do and how you want to spend your time. I can give you one personal example from my family. A couple of months ago, my daughter was at home on a Sunday afternoon. The libraries had closed, and she realized that she had to finish up a paper on Beowulf, which she neglected to remember until this late time.
Uh-huh.
Turns out that she'd left the text of Beowulf in her locker at school and all her class notes and just had a few things that she'd started with. Now, when I was growing up, that would have put me in a great panic. But we just turned to the internet, and within a few minutes, we had the full text of Beowulf on our home computer. We had reference notes on Beowulf. We had encyclopedia articles on Beowulf. And she had all that material that she could use to write her paper and turn it in on Monday morning.
Should we worry when we think about, you know, here we are singing the praises of Mosaic and the World Wide Web and the internet. What kinds of concerns should parents and administrators have when we speak of computers and education? It can't be quite as rosy a picture as I suppose all the PR people want us to think it is.
Well, the first thing that you have to remember is all the information that exists is not on the computer and probably never will be. So you can't do your research solely on computer and expect that you've done a thorough job. You have to go back and use other forms of information. Being in the museum business, we're very excited about images of our artifacts going online, but at the same time, we don't want anybody to think that that means you should never go to a museum again.
Right. It's not going to put you all out of business.
Let's hope not.
Again, David Allison, we're talking about computers and education. You're from the Smithsonian Institution, one of the not only nominees, but one of the winners of this year's Computer World Smithsonian Awards program was Linda Roberts. Linda is a longtime educator, knows a lot about computers and education, works for the Department of Education. What is she doing? Why is she worthy of this award?
Well, Linda Roberts was our leader of the Educational Leadership Award this year in the Computer World Smithsonian Awards program. She's the chief advisor to the Secretary of Education on educational technology. In fact, she's the first person to hold that position and be very close to the Secretary of Education. Clearly, things have gone far enough so that the Secretary believes that at his right hand, he needs somebody who understands the role of computers and the change of education that they're bringing about.
And what kind of work is she doing exactly? I mean, she travels around the country and she sings the praises of computers in the schools, but be specific for me.
There are many different ways that somebody could approach a job like the one that Linda has. Her principal goal has been to determine what's working and help other people see that, mm-hmm. not to try to have the government run a program or set the standards, but really to have the government identify those things that people in local school districts all over the country are doing and help other people become aware of it and follow those models.
All right. I had an opportunity to talk to Linda Roberts, Dr. Roberts, when we were up in Washington for the Computer World Smithsonian Awards program. Let's listen to some of her comments.
The evidence seems to suggest that what technology does is largely enhance the role of teachers. Teachers report that after the initial struggle of, you know, really figuring out how to use these tools and use the applications that are increasingly available, what they find is they rethink their own time, they rethink how they teach, and they describe themselves as actually being better teachers. And I think what they mean is that they are better coaches, that they are better facilitators, that all of the information that a student needs in any particular subject matter area is no longer their purview only. They can draw on other resources. They can bring other experts into their classroom. For example, if they're on the World Wide Web, or able to be connected via distance learning to another classroom or to other people in the community. So there's this sense that teachers who are really experienced and accomplished users of computers and advanced technologies, that the technology really improves their teaching, that they can do more, not less, in the long run.
David Allison, again, we've just heard from Dr. Linda Roberts from the Department of Education. Should we, to put it very directly, should we think of the computer as the answer to all of our educational woes?
There's no one answer to all of our educational woes. I do think that the computer can be a way to expand the horizons of students when it's properly used. I grew up in a small town in North Florida and never knew that a library could be much bigger than what I had in my town. When I went to Washington, D.C. many years ago and saw the Library of Congress, it was a real eye-opening experience for me. Now, in that same town, I could have the Library of Congress at my fingertips.
David Allison, we're talking about computers and education. How is the rubber going to meet the road here, so to speak, when you come down to the nub of it all, which is to say teaching? How do computers affect what goes on in the life of teachers?
Computers are another technology that will change how teaching is done or should be done. But they won't eliminate the role of the teacher, and they won't make a teacher unnecessary. If a teacher was not necessary, certainly you could have just taken a young person and dropped him into the best library in the world and had an educated person 12 years later.
Right.
Teachers help young people learn how to think, learn how to analyze. They guide them through the process of thinking and learning. Now, with computer technology and networks all over the world, students have access to all kinds of information, and yet they still need that guidance. They still need help. They still need someone to show them the way, to encourage them, to help them avoid mistakes. And that role of teaching in some ways becomes even more necessary.
Well, apropos of that, let's listen to one of the award winners this year from the Computer World Smithsonian Awards Program. And again, that would be Dr. Roberts from the Department of Education.
Well, I think the most important thing we can do with everybody, with all of our customers, if you want to think about it that way, our students, our teachers, our parents, our members of the community, is most importantly to listen to them, to figure out how we can facilitate what they want to do and do it in such a way that we are not in the way. We are, in a way, like the teachers I described, guides on the side, coaches, facilitators. So much of what we are trying to do in the new technology initiatives is to provide resources, experts, people from the communities themselves who can be resources to others in their community, to build the capacity in a local school district or in a state to make good investments in technology. We would never tell anybody what to do. That's not our role. The second thing that we can do is we can point to the most promising practices, the efforts that really have compelling results, data that students are really learning, that this is making a difference in their skills and their knowledge. And we can do that. That's an important role for us to do. We should be doing research and evaluation. And the third thing that we want to do with our new technology initiatives is support the ingenuity that's out there. We have a new technology challenge grant program that has generated such broad interest, because what it essentially does is say to local districts, to software developers, to telephone companies, to universities, come together and design the kind of program you would like to have and help us, and we can help you make a difference. We can't fund all of what you want to do, but we can provide you with the seed dollars to move your projects forward. And we've had just an incredible response to the Technology Challenge Grant Program.
David Allison, we are talking about computers and society and education. You are from the Smithsonian Institution, a curator of information technology, the exhibit up there. When we talked about the Computer World Smithsonian Awards Program, we talked about the leadership categories, but we haven't really gotten around to the application awards. What are they all about?
Wayne, these two categories are important. The leadership awards are for individuals. And then what we call our category awards are for different areas of application. Often these awards are given to groups or to a series of people who work on these applications. We've divided those up into three different areas. One related to the workplace, that includes things such as business and related services, finance, government and nonprofit institutions, manufacture, all the things related to how people work in their normal jobs. A second area is arts and sciences. This includes media arts and entertainment, medicine, and science itself. And finally, there's an area called community. In this area, we give awards for environment, energy and agriculture, transportation, and education.
Mm-hmm.
So the purpose of the awards is to track the impact of information technology across the whole breadth of our society.
What you're testifying to here, David, is the incredible pervasiveness of the computer in our modern culture. You know, I have argued with you here playfully and contentiously about, you know, are we really going to move into the information age? The answer seems to be an inevitable yes.
We're already there. Our awards include everything from recognizing the people who did the animation for Jurassic Park to the people that are designing an artificial heart using computer simulation. They include an award for people that did a system for trucks and allow trucks to track where they are and where the next loads will be using global positioning systems with satellites. So they cover just about everything related to our modern world.
David K. Allison is curator of Computers, Information, and Society at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. On this program, you also heard from John Zebarth of the University of Illinois and Linda Roberts of the U.S. Department of Education. Major funding for this edition of Soundings came from the Computer World Smithsonian Awards Program, established in 1989 to honor innovative uses of information technology that benefit society. Cassette tapes are available for $10 postpaid. Our address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 780. That's $10, program number 780. Our address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Information about the Computer World Smithsonian Awards and the 1995 Technology Innovation Collection is now available online through the Innovation Network, a collaborative effort of Novell Incorporated, Computer World, and the Smithsonian Institution. The Innovation Network can be accessed on the World Wide Web at http://innovate.si.edu. The Innovation Network stores the same information found in the archives at the National Museum of American History. Next week on Soundings, Inside Russia 1995. Listen for a conversation featuring Svetlana Boehm of Harvard University. She'll be here to talk about her new book, Commonplaces, an account of everyday life in contemporary Russia. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. Learning Online, Information Technology and American Education, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for a conversation with David Allison of the Smithsonian Institution. He'll be here to talk about how computers are changing America's educational landscape. He'll also discuss the Computer World Smithsonian Awards, recognizing leadership in information technology from science to business and education. Finally, you'll hear from information age innovators from the University of Illinois and the U.S. Department of Education. Learning Online, this week on Soundings.